This programming is sponsored by the UH Health Family Care Center, offering primary care and behavioral health services on the University of Houston campus. Health insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, accepted. New patient appointments and more at 832-UH-CARES.
This programming is sponsored by Linscomb Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at LinscombWealth.com.
Hey, Party Politics listeners, we're in fundraising mode this week. So if you like the podcast, please go to HoustonPublicMedia.org and click on the donate button.
Take a moment and do it now. We're in that time where we really need your resources. We really need your help to make it keep going.
Speaking of the show, welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us as we talk a little politics. Well, Brandon, we've had one heck of a crazy week here, haven't we?
We've got chicken fingers, we've got fajita strips, and a barbecue controversy. It's a pretty meat-heavy week, Jay.
Yes, exactly. Well, let's start off with our favorite national topics of the week. We got a little White House in turmoil, Michael Cohen pleading the fifth. We've got crises going on with cabinet nominees and potential cabinet nominees, and our fellow Texan, Ronny Jackson, our favorite medical doctor, apparently, is withdrawing.
Yeah, that's
Dr. Feelgood, right?
Dr. Feelgood, right. Yeah, this came to light because apparently there had been some claims about him creating a hostile work environment, excessive drinking on the job, and improperly dispensing medicine to White House staff. These are the kind of things that definitely get presidents into trouble and are definitely a black mark. There was not enough vetting on this, to be sure, right? It's like the two men followed each other on Instagram, and that was enough to vet, right? Vetting works, Jay. We know that when you do this properly, that you're more likely to be successful in getting your nominees. President Trump has only been successful about 60% of the time in getting high-level cabinet members compared to President George W. Bush at 76%. So the fact that they had similar political dynamics makes us worry that there is a real problem here for the White House.
Yeah, I don't even think this is much of sort of the political alignment of the two men. I think it's much more of the personal relationship. He was the personal physician for three previous presidents. And I think the thing that makes me wonder more than anything is how long this behavior was going on. We had 8 years of what was a scandal-free White House with President Obama. All the time we had a drunk physician who was dispensing medication for recreational purposes on Air Force One. Kind of a crazy story, and there's going to be a great book coming out of it. But for now, it certainly makes everyone's head scratch a bit. And where does President Trump go now, going forward? I mean, who does he have out there for potential VA sector?
Well, there's this talk about having Rick Perry shift over. That would be one option. But I think that no matter who it is, they have to vet carefully. We also have Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator, who's testifying this week on a range of different issues that have come up, including a really expensive soundproof phone booth, other expenditures, including raises for staff and flights on first class airlines. So, like, there's definitely a problem here in terms of vetting people at the White House, and they need to be more careful going forward.
Let's shift gears a bit, talk about the courts, because the president got a pretty thorough slap across the face by the court system. His big issue, his pet peeve issue, has been DACA. He has been trying to rescind it, but the court gave him, I think, a pretty stern response on that.
Yeah, and to some degree, they gave him kind of marching orders as to what's going to happen. Now, we've talked about DACA a bunch, but this is basically a program that protects a certain class of individuals who came here as youngsters and are now looking for some kind of a temporary citizenship. And that's really part of the question, right? Immigration issues have been at the forefront of elections, as well as the kind of political fighting we've seen. So the president now has a ruling from U.S. District Court judge that says that their justification for why they have undone DACA was flimsy. That's a quote, Jay. It's flimsy. And essentially that if they couldn't come up with some kind of a solution, that the whole process would have to be restored. The whole DACA issue would have to be restored.
Right. And the court kind of went on and even said that not only must you continue it, you've got to reissue it. You've got to move forward. And for the foreseeable future, DACA is here. Now, the politics of it are interesting because I think in an interesting way, it's like a giant pressure valve release for Congress and the White House in dealing with immigration reform. This has been one of those areas that people have rallied around, folks we refer to as the Dreamers. This helps them. And so it takes away some of the immediacy for needing to deal with immigration reform and kind of punts it for a few more months or maybe indefinitely. But right now, I think the ruling is pretty significant.
It's still a political problem for the president, especially for Republicans, right, who have made this the number one issue. And to me, it also underscores, I mean, I think you're exactly right, but it underscores how dysfunctional Washington is generally and specifically on immigration, right, which has been an issue that they've been trying to solve for at least a decade in earnest. So I think it underscores some of that potential dysfunction.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, immigration is a huge issue, probably no more so than in the state of Arizona, which was kind of ground central. It had another sort of mini little earthquake. Arizona 8, a congressional district that President Trump had won by over 20 points. I think Mitt Romney had carried it by 25 a few years ago when he ran in 2012. They had a special election to replace, disgraced member of Congress, and Representative Franks, who had to resign because of a scandal. They had a special election. And lo and behold, the Democrat got within 5 points. What happened?
This is a pretty serious wake-up call for Republicans. This district is home to a lot of the suburbs of Phoenix and also home to the Arizona Cardinals home stadium and also home to a pretty strong signal that the Republicans are in big trouble if this keeps up. A couple things struck me. Number one, although there are national Republicans poured about $1 million in to help the woman who was running on the Republican side as state for this, as she was a state senator, the money was a very little help, right? That it still didn't give her the margin that Trump had. Number two, suburbs are changing, and you see that happening all over. And if it happens in a place like Arizona, which typically is very red, I think you've got something of a foot. And the final thing is that female candidates are doing well, right? We've talked about this before. There may not be a blue wave, but there's certainly a pink wave. And the number of Democratic women running is, I think, going to be pretty powerful in unseating some incumbent Republicans.
So what we've seen so far, Brandon, which I think is interesting, is massive wave advantage for the Democrats in the Northeast.
Yeah,
we've now seen it. We saw it in the Atlantic, Mid-Atlantic and in Virginia. We saw it in the Deep South in Alabama. We've seen it in Michigan and Wisconsin. But we didn't expect to see it in sort of the modern Southwest. Mm-hmm. Here in Texas, I'm just going to use our perspective. We've got probably 10 or 15 congressional districts that are right in that same space as Arizona 8. I think it's a fascinating thing to see if that shift that you talk about in the suburbs continues in places like Texas and Oklahoma and California that we know is already trending heavily, D.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. One of the best parts, Jay, about being president is that you get to have lavish and really wonderful state dinners, and the president has held his very first one. Tell us about that.
Yes, exactly. And it was put together by the First Lady, Melania Trump, but he hosted the President of France, Emmanuel Macron.
Well done.
Exactly. I've been spending all day.
In the mirror,
Exactly, exactly. But they have it's an interesting relationship. Macron's famously sort of a globalist and sort of his pushback against the nationalist tide that's occurring in Europe. Trump, of course, is Mr. America First. And so you would not expect the two men to naturally bond, but they seem to have. Macron's very good at apparently maintaining these personal relationships with people who otherwise wouldn't like him. And he got quite a bit of pushback when he gave a speech before Congress that ended up having folks like Ted Cruz get angry, saying he insulted America.
Right. This, for the president, is a chance to cement these bilateral relations for a country that there's been some definite schisms. And so this is a relatively low-stakes visit, and the two seem to have hit it off with a little bromance. Not unlike the bromance between the president and Kanye West. who said that the president was like his brother and that they shared the same dragon energy.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever the heck that means.
I think you and I share dragon energy. Don't you feel it?
Yeah, most definitely.
Well, Jay, turning back here to Texas, there's been some interesting developments on the Houston Independent School District front. In my notes here, all I have is HISD WTF? So tell me, what is happening and why are people being arrested at these meetings?
Yeah, I know. If you thought Trump and Kanye was a WTF moment, then what happened at HISD in Houston the other night certainly was. So HISD is dealing with this issue of 10 chronically underperforming schools. House Bill 1842 mandates that if they are not performing for 5 consecutive years, that they are subject to being closed, or the school board itself would be dissolved and a board of managers would come in. So there were these hearings associated with turning these schools over to create an in-district charter. Well, a lot of folks were upset by it, and it created a lot of hullabaloo, so much so to the point that the meeting had to be shut down in the middle, and quite literally people were dragged away, HISD police dragged away and arrested, and then subsequently released 3 individuals. But it created a just giant head-scratching moment of just terrible optics of people essentially wanting their voice to be heard but being dragged away in handcuffs.
Yeah. And so now, in order to solve this problem, either HISD has to get some kind of an accountability or sanction waiver from the TEA commissioner, Mike Morath, or they have to have some other kind of plan, which it doesn't seem like there's consensus on. This is your area of expertise, Jace. So I'll ask you, is this a symptom of a kind of rush to accountability that the legislature has put into place? Like, they don't have a sense of kind of exactly what they want to do to sort of solve the conundrum of public education in Texas, but they have to do something to show that they're in that field. So do you think that's what this is, or is this simply a fact that HISD itself is not able to be able to devote the resources needed or the, I don't know, the kind of architecture needed to be able to fix this problem?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. So in the case of the school districts, just statewide in Texas, public education is underfunded. We've talked about this for a while. There's about $1.5 billion hole in ISD budgets statewide, largely because the state's not been providing enough dollars. But at the same time, this reflects a frustration by many in the legislature and just statewide that you have schools that have essentially not done right by kids for a long period of time. The schools in question, many of them have essentially not been performing over 10 years in many of the cases. So you're dealing with a situation where you want to solve the problem. So this was the proverbial sort of gun to the head of HISD to kind of fix it, or you're not going to exist anymore. And that was really what it's behind. But I think the fundamental question is, how is HISD going to respond? They've only got a couple choices left now. They either have to close them and then maybe restart them in another form, or they're going to have to cede that to the Texas Education Agency, which could either close them themselves or essentially take over the school district. Both choices are hard. Both choices are difficult. But I think part of the problem now is, as you said, without waivers, not just waivers from accountability, they need waivers from sanctions. Because even if you, because of Harvey, gave them an extra year, you would need to give them an extra year from potential penalties, because at least 7 of these schools have been underperforming for over 5 years.
Yeah, my worry is that TEA is not equipped to handle this. And this is going to happen more often, not just HISD, but also at school districts across the state.
Right. This is a statewide problem. This is the first of many. But when you have the largest school district in the state facing it, I think it shines a bigger spotlight, particularly on the fact we've got a commission in Austin now looking at the problem. The public education is underfunded. This is just another symptom of that.
Well, we've got other emergencies, one in Congressional District 27. As we've talked about before, Blake Farenthold has resigned in disgrace, we should note. And the governor is not happy about his options in terms of calling a special session. So he asked the attorney general to weigh in on whether or not he was able to execute emergency powers to call for an expedited election. The attorney general said, yes, you may. And so effectively, we're having a new election. But one question is, who's going to pay for this? Because elections, Jay, elections are expensive. The governor has an idea about who ought to pay.
Yeah, exactly. He seems to think that the $84,000 that Blake Farenthold used from taxpayers to pay off settlements for harassment allegations should be used to, in fact, fund this election. Well, the governor, it's interesting, right? Apparently, Harvey wasn't an emergency for the governor
right.
to call a special session. And a lot of other issues weren't emergencies.
Right.
But this filling of a seat that is up for re-election, mind you, in November,
right,
is an emergency. So, I mean, I think it's a real issue here. The governor obviously got some blowback on the costs associated with it. So he's trying to sort of save face by suggesting that Farenthold ought to pay for it himself. There's no way he can compel that. This is just, again, sort of a weird political position that Governor Abbott has put himself in for no apparent reason.
He's trying to shame Fahrenholt into paying for it, which I don't think he will. But I frankly like the move because I think it shows that he wants to be responsible and that we should essentially hold politicians accountable for this. Fahrenholt has said he would consider paying the money back. And so this is one opportunity to make that happen. But at the end of the day, my sense is that, you know, Fahrenholt set the table, so he's got to eat the meal. And the hope is that at least the taxpayers won't have to front the money to pay for a special election. So independent of everything else, I think that at least we have some accountability on work.
Well, speaking of eating the meal, when you're eating a plate of barbecue, Brandon, you expect your half a pound of brisket to weigh a half a pound.
My beef ribs better be a pound if I order a pound, Jay.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But how do you know? It's the scale that weighs it. And let me tell you something. We on this show have been critical of our agriculture commissioner, Sid Miller, but he's right on this. So what's happened here, Brandon, is the state of Texas last legislative session passed a bill that said, you know what? Scales and measures that are used to weigh meat should be accurate and verified, except in one possibility, when it's for food that's immediately consumed, in this case, barbecue restaurants.
That's right. Yeah, the Attorney General's non-binding ruling on this says that a court would probably find that rules the Ag Commissioner wrote or helped write are invalid because customers buying food for immediate consumption are required to eat it on premises. And so that should have an exemption. This is an interesting dynamic. To me, the lesson here is don't mess with Texas barbecue. So at least that's the first thing to think about. But the other is that Sid Miller has gotten into a lot of trouble for essentially increasing fees on all farmers, ranchers, and lots of different things that are kind of under his purview as ag commissioner. So this is actually a continuation of that. Will Republicans strike back at him politically for raising these fees? I think we're sort of seeing that. But I don't know if it's the case that Kim Olson, who's a Democrat running against him, can peel off enough Republicans to get that support.
Well, Brandon, all I'm going to say is don't mess with Texas barbecue eaters, all right?
True.
Because a pound needs to be a pound. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to dive into all these great issues related to the courts that are affecting Texas.
So, Jay, we've got a big issue at the court this week. In addition to the fact that the president is defending his travel ban, we also have a Texas case on gerrymandering, which is being heard in front of the court. The question are myriad, really two. One is whether or not the issue should even be in court, especially at the Supreme Court. And the other is whether or not there is a kind of actual discriminatory intent or effect. Two different questions there, actually. So the plaintiffs say that the lines that were drawn essentially did so to crack a sizable Latino and African-American communities in Dallas and Fort Worth and Houston into districts which would be essentially then dilute their power, making those districts non-responsive. Texas says they were acting in good faith and were simply codifying the rules that the courts put into place. This has been in litigation since forever, right? Since 2011. Many of our listeners weren't even born when this happened, so we've been in court a bunch of times. The lower courts have made at least 10 findings of intentional discrimination against the state of Texas. And so we are yet again at a point where we need to talk about what this means for Texas and what are the implications.
Yeah, so there's sort of two competing things going on. You've got one set of facts that basically say that in order to create a whole series of minority-oriented districts, they created oddly shaped districts that sort of peel together communities from all across the state. So you've got a couple of districts that run hundreds of miles that are paper thin. If you look at them, it looks like, you know, sort of you have the Rorschach test of just throwing ink on a canvas.
Mm-hmm. It's all blotchy, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, it's very difficult to see. And so it sort of begs the question of kind of the reality and the reason behind that. Now, competing with that are the notion of splitting, or as you say, cracking communities to dilute strength. What we know is that part of the reason this line of cases is continuing is that there have been emails and correspondence that seem to indicate that they wanted to use race as a factor in drawing these districts in a way to help prevent certain people from getting elected. And we know that from emails. We know that from some of the information that was out there. And that, I think, is what's driving it. The plans themselves were modifications by the court at the district level. And the suggestion that at least that the state of Texas is making is, we didn't really draw these plans anymore. These are court-drawn plans, and so they ought to be constitutional. The ramifications, I think, are changing some districts for 2 to 3, maybe making things a little bit more competitive. But in communities like CD7 here in the Houston area, or CD32 in the Dallas area, you might actually strengthen Republicans mm-hmm. if you side with the plaintiffs here.
It's a domino effect for sure. If you draw one line a different way, it's going to create an effect on the next district. So that's definitely the case, as you say. The question here is about intent versus effect at its core. Like you said, Texas wants to claim that the maps were drawn in 2013 under a kind of court-sanctioned supervision, right? They drew the lines. They were thought to be discriminatory. The court eventually helped them to adapt those lines. The question is then, what is the carryover intent? I love this language, right? The carryover intent is sort of as you're getting to in the evidentiary side of things. What was the intent from the legislatures in terms of drawing those lines? Was it originally intended to be racially discriminatory? And then does the 2013 sanction by the court essentially absolve that? This is really a big part of the question that the plaintiffs would like to have on point, right? The plaintiffs say that if they can prove that 2011 maps were drawn with discrimination in mind, even if it's the case that 2013 was sanctioned by the court, then it's the case that that's something that would pull Texas back under the preclearance under Section 3 of the Voting Rights Act, which would essentially require any kind of change like this to go back to the Justice Department to be adjudicated before it was done.
Well, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to tell you what that carryover intent was and why this case matters so much to you.
So, Jay, there's a lot at stake here in terms of the Texas-style gerrymandering. What do we take from it, and what do you think is going to happen?
All right. So, for me, I think it's nothing more than a situation where, for a long time in Texas, we have drawn these lines for whichever party was in power to benefit them. So, we know that from a partisan perspective, that sort of supersedes all. The real question is whether there was an intent to dilute and pack, and in some cases, crack minorities. I think the evidence seems to point in that direction. I think you're going to see some fundamental changes. And the immediate impact, I think, is to make a few more districts in play that otherwise wouldn't be. But this is all leading up to me to the big case coming out of Wisconsin and Pennsylvania that's going to deal with extreme partisan gerrymandering. This is the beginning of a whole new world in how we draw districts.
I think it's a great point, right? This doesn't exist in a vacuum. There are other cases are going to affect what Texas does in the future, because this won't be the end of it, even if the court decides that they're going to accept the fact that there were racially drawn lines. My guess in terms of what happens here is that you're going to find that the court is going to reject that these were intentionally discriminatory, but the effect is still discriminatory, which means that the state will be potentially pulled back under preclearance. At the end of the day, I guess people should care about this because there's a fear that politicians are picking voters instead of voters picking politicians. And so I find this to be patently unfair and an undemocratic way to draw these lines. If discrimination exists, as the plaintiffs are arguing, then it needs to be undone. And apparently we cannot trust legislatures to make this happen. So something else has to be accomplished to make this happen. But no matter what happens, Jay, even if we have a ruling on this in June, which we're likely to have, I think it's still going to be in the courts for at least another 2 or 3 years, which means we've got probably 2 or 3 election cycles where you're going to have these maps to have to live with.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Any questions? Shoot us a tweet with the hashtag PartyPoliticsPod or email us at PartyPoliticsPod@HoustonPublicMedia.org. Thanks to our producer, Edel Hallin, who shares our dragon energy, and to our engineer, Todd, the Candyman Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Runninghouse. We'll see you next week.